Doomberg, head writer for the Doomberg team and Substack. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Tom, great to be back with you again. Congrats on all your success. I know how hard it is to start something from scratch, and you've been doing a great job with it.
Well, I really appreciate that. I definitely am very grateful for guidance that you've given me over the years. I couldn't do it without, you know, great allies in the space like you. You know, one of your connections I spoke with yesterday, Tony Greer, really appreciate, you know, getting introduced to you by him, or the other way around, getting introduced by you. Yeah. And we'll get to a little bit of that conversation, in today's talk here, but you know, Doomberg, you always have a really amazing way of analyzing the world and understanding how, you know, likely things are going to play out. So with yields all over the world, there, I want to get, let's say, your understanding of how this accumulation of debt ends up culminating in something like a sovereign debt crisis. And could this war be one of the catalysts that is maybe seen in retrospect as kicking some countries over the edge?
Yeah, so I think the war is part of a mosaic of events that are happening at great speed that in isolation would be historically significant, but they're happening one on top of each other at a pace that makes it difficult to take a step back sometimes and observe the big picture. Mm-hmm. We note with interest that Russian President Vladimir Putin was in Beijing overnight, during the day for them, of course, but overnight for you and me. And he and Chinese President Xi Jinping signed what I think will be viewed as a pretty historic document, a strategic document around what they're calling a new multipolar framework for organizing the world. And embedded in that framework is overt steps towards removing U.S. dollar hegemony from the equation in global trade. And we wrote a piece last week on China sort of finally drawing a line on this in the sand on U.S. sanctions. And I spoke at length with our mutual friend Grant Williams on the podcast that he and I do together called This Week in Doom about connecting those dots. I think we are at the very late stages of U.S. global supremacy. And we are moving to that multipolar world. And I view, well, we view as a team, the war in Ukraine and now the war in Iran as separate battles in World War III that kicked off in 2014. And if we're lucky, we'll soon end. So I know that's a lot and not directly answering your question, but the sovereign debt crisis that you refer to is really sort of late stage U.S. dollar financial system reaching its predictable apex, which is in order to support the system, the U.S. has to generate debt. and then in order to keep the price of maintaining and rolling and growing that debt lower, rolling over and growing that debt lower, low enough to be manageable, U.S. dollar needs to be, you know, the main vehicle by which global commerce is executed. And that works great so long as the U.S. government does not abuse the neutrality of its chokehold on the financial system. And it is inarguable that they have done so in the past 15 to 20 years. And so the 10-year treasury that I'm watching every day on my Bloomberg launch pad and the, you know, British gilts and all of this sort of Western-backed sovereign debt reaching interest rates, Japan reaching interest rates that are mathematically impossible to service and roll over the existing giant piles of debt means that the great washout is accelerating and will have to appear at some point. Which is why we think in the long term it's extremely bullish for gold as measured in U.S. dollars, even if the current war in the Middle East is a bit of a headwind for short-term gold prices.
Doomberg, you know, you mentioned British gilts, Japanese yen. These you know, yields all over the world are kind of, I don't want to say maybe blowing out, but definitely breaking a decades long trend. So because the US enjoyed this ability to have the reserve currency of the world coupled with their domestic energy production, does that put them in a different league of sorts than a country, let's say like Japan, who arguably in some cases has a more dire debt situation coupled with heavy reliance on importing their energy?
Japan's a bit of a special case. Japan is one of the reasons why the U.S. was able to keep a lid on interest rates, because the Japanese invested so much of their savings overseas. And the Japanese debt situation doesn't look as bad if you repatriate that debt, but those investments, those assets from overseas, but in so doing would, of course, potentially collapse the current system. And so this is the perpetual rub of the situation. And in fact, this brings me to a point that is always a point of contention for us, which is, you know, the measure of the strength of the US dollar is not the DXY. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pound and the yen and the euro, they're just derivatives of the US dollar. They're proxies for the American anchored Western financial system. And so they're all highly correlated. And this is why I think you're seeing rates in those countries, you know, trade in lockstep with each other. And when the system collapses, I mean, there'll be no safe havens, except for, ironically, the most sanctioned countries in the world, like Iran and Russia, North Korea, and China. Why? Because they have been forced to build in resiliency. And that resiliency would be a wonderful asset if what we believe is about to transpire unfolds.
Perhaps resiliency, and you could almost say independence maybe from the dollar system?
Yeah, well, look, ironically, the country that cares the least about collapsing the global economy is Iran, because it hardly participates in it. Mm-hmm. And that's not by choice, that's by force, the force of U.S. sanctions and a forced de-dollarization of the Iranian economy. And the Iranian economy has inarguably persisted rather well, far better than most analysts anticipated before this war kicked off. They have advanced drone technology, advanced missile technology, highly educated society. Their governance structure has persisted despite the full weight of the U.S. Air Force and the Israeli Air Force dropping bombs on them for some 40 days. Iran has far outperformed expectations in this war. And because it is so highly sanctioned, it has been forced to thrive under a different system. And therefore, in a perverse outcome, it has a head start on preparing for the multipolar world.
Dumer, do you think that this is going to be possibly one of the most significant energy shocks that the world has seen once the inventories have quit kind of softening the initial blow of flow out of the Strait of Hormuz?
I think much depends on whether the war kicks off again. I think it already is a historic energy shock. I think that's undeniable. The full effects of it have been cushioned, as you say, at least in part, by the release of inventories, but also from a better than expected ability to reroute energy and fertilizer and other critical goods out of the Middle East in a way that circumvents the Strait of Hormuz. But if the war kicks back off and the energy infrastructure is severely damaged and the Red Sea is closed by the Houthis and a full-blown sort of violent exchange occurs between Iran, attacked by Israel and the U.S., and the Gulf states attacked by Iran, all bets are off, and that would be a true energy shock beyond which very little could be done to insulate the world from the global depression that would follow.
I know you've probably spoken about this at length, but, you know, being an energy analyst, having that background, what are some of the downstream effects that you are most worried about? That maybe, you know, obviously we understand the constraints on oil, sulfuric acid, helium, products like that. But is there anything else that you think is worthy of considering at this point, how that ends up affecting the rest of the world as well?
It all depends on your time frame, Tom. So in the medium to long term, we're actually quite optimistic. The long-term real price of all commodities is lower. The greater the shock, the greater the response. The closure of the Strait of Hormuz is a card that can only be played once. They've played it. It will be circumvented, new supply will be brought online, demand will be destroyed, alternative sources of energy will be discovered and brought to market. The value of resilience over efficiency will be reestablished in global markets and as policies selected by global governments. And so in the long run, this is actually all quite healthy. The short run is a different matter. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that all of this could catalyze is that end of the financial system that we talked about. A true economic crisis is just not something the current structure can bear. You very quickly get into printer press goes burr, you know, the debt is extinguished by the Fed. That process is repeated around the world. And we get the sort of debt jubilee that people have been talking about and we have talked about over time. And we're much closer to that than the day-to-day reading of the news might imply, which is why I sort of started my first answer with that, mm-hmm. you know, observation that the speed of the historic events is such that it can be a bit dizzying. You know, there's a flooding of the field of this stuff. And so, you know, we are quite optimistic in the medium to long term. The human endeavor has never been denied historically and won't be denied because of this crisis. The friction of the transition depends on whether the war heats up again. And that's the great challenge that I think faces President Trump, is that there's no easy way out. There is no military solution to the war in Iran. And the only path that preserves those assets, which have been laid bare for their vulnerability, involves a what Trump would characterize as a humiliating retreat. And he's just not capable of doing that, I don't think. His demeanor and his personality would find that abhorrent. Mm-hmm. And so when we saw his Truth Social post calling off the latest strike at the request of Qatar and Bahrain and the UAE and Saudi Arabia, or whoever was listed in that post. There's actually more truth to that than some of the more cynical interpretations of what Trump is up to might conclude. Those countries know that their assets will be destroyed and there's literally nothing they can do about it. The Iranians have explicitly said as much. And if you look at what the Iranians were saying before February 28th and what they subsequently did, I think those warnings should be taken quite seriously. By the way, long shot prediction, if war kicks off again, the latest news out of Iran, which we follow closely, is that they're likely to target European countries from which American airplanes are basing. And they have the missile technology to do it. And I can assure you that the missile defenses of the European countries will be exposed to be woefully inadequate.
You mentioned earlier the the energy infrastructure, let's say, around Iran, you know, in many of the Gulf states, not being, let's say, terminally damaged. Is this because of their ability to rebuild it that quickly? Is it because of Iran's strategic strikes on some of these assets?
Iran has not targeted them at the scale with which they promised to do so this time around. Yes, damage was done to certain facilities, but they were pinpricks compared to what could have been done. So this is the sword that hangs over the Trump administration as they ponder what to do next militarily. Mm-hmm. There is no technology to resist what Iran is capable of doing. And the U.S. has proven that it can't destroy those missile launching sites at a pace with the inventory of attack missiles that it has that would meaningfully deflect Iran's ability to inflict that damage. Mm-hmm. And so you have this, the reason there's a ceasefire, look, if there was a military solution to the Strait of Hormuz situation, we wouldn't be on day 80 of this war without, like, with the strait still closed. I mean, any fair reading of the evidence is that the U.S. needed this ceasefire. The U.S. and Israel asked for this ceasefire. Maybe they have reloaded, but I think that the U.S. missile shortage is something we've been flagging for more than a year, is widely known. The Chinese know, the Russians know. That's why we think this meeting in Beijing is so important.
Well, I'd like to get to that, but before we do, considering all of the different religions that have a place in that area of the world, do you consider any of the, you know, the religious or the eschatological angle that is also kind of, you know, set as an undertone to basically what is happening over there? Do you consider or have you had any discussions or exposure to the eschatological nature of,
I mean,
an end time like this?
You can't peruse the propaganda of Israel and Saudi Arabia and Iran and the U.S. like we've done without encountering way more religion than perhaps you set out to look for. Mm-hmm. It's not our area of expertise, and I will choose my words carefully so as to minimize the risk of you being demonetized. There's a huge amount of anti-Semitism online. There's a huge amount of legitimate grievances against the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, we think. There's a huge amount of calls for retaliation amongst the Shia community for the death of their religious leader, which occurred at the opening moments of this war. I mean, when you read the Iranian propaganda, our analogy to friends over here is that the U.S. and Israel effectively took out the Pope during Easter Mass at the Vatican. And how would Catholics around the world respond to what they would undoubtedly call a provocation? Yes, to the average Fox News viewer, you know, the U.S. and Israel took out a dangerous mullah who deserved it, but that's not how it's portrayed over there. And I think it's important to see how the other side views things. And so it is an unfortunate but undeniable fact that there are religious and extremist undertones across virtually all dimensions of this war. I'm no theologian and I claim no expertise in this area, but you can't but encounter it as you peruse primary source documents in an effort to understand what's going on the ground. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that we're on day 80 of this war, Doomberg, and as I understood it, or, you know, as I understand it, I believe it's after 60 days that they have to go to Congress to basically be approved to continue the war. Is that something that is also standing in the way here?
No. So Trump and Hegseth and team have found what they believe is a clever legal workaround for that legal constraint, which is that the implementation of the ceasefire brought to an end that conflict, and any new conflict would restart that 60-day window. So when you read the letter the Trump administration sent to Congress, and you listen to the careful way in which Hegseth, in contrast with Trump, who's never careful with his words, the words that Hegseth chooses to use were written by a lawyer. If the war kicks off again in the Middle East, the Trump administration will credibly claim, and Congress seems unlikely to contest that claim, that it has a new, fresh 60-day window with which to operate. It should be noted that the U.S. Congress has had, both in the House and in the Senate, bills put to the floor that would prohibit Trump from going back to war with Iran, and both of those have failed. In other words, Congress had an opportunity to reassert its constitutional power, and it chose not to exercise that power. And so in a way, it is indirectly voting to give the president the authority he needs. It is our view that constitutional constraints will not hold back President Trump from doing whatever he decides is needed to be done. Mm-hmm.
Duberg, I read a piece that, you know, as energy analysts, you would have taken the over on, you know, $150 oil, considering the constraints over the Strait of Hormuz. And, you know, bringing up Tony again, I spoke with him yesterday, and he said that this energy crisis won't hit the markets in a meaningful way until, you know, there's a JP Morgan analyst that can't get his Starbucks or fill up his BMW. Is it possible that the markets are misunderstanding the severity of this situation because of something like a recency bias, because we haven't had something like this for so long?
You know, I love Tony, and I read his stuff every day, and I'm an active participant in his wonderful Slack channel. And I love the way that he frames the markets. He's a great guy. I think that another friend of Tony's, Jack Johnson, the author of Market Vibes, another great Substack that I read every day, twice a day, actually, at least twice every trading day. JJ makes the point that I think is important, which is in the oil business, everybody lies. And retrospectively, an awful lot of lying was being done in the oil business in 2025. The size of the glut of production was far larger than market participants were portraying. China in particular was buying far more oil just for this purpose, probably buying an extra million to even 1.5 million barrels a day, sticking it underground, leaving it at sea. Huge amount of lying being done in the oil business. And as JJ pointed out, this tsunami of excess supply is now being burned off at $100 a barrel, $110 a barrel, which is a far better thing for the industry than to see it burned off at $30 a barrel, which is where we were headed before this war broke out. And so one wonders whether, just as that excess inventory is finally burned off, whether peace will prevail. So there's lots of reasons to be cynical, but I do think, to circle back to the beginning of your question, yeah, we got it wrong. I mean, we would have taken the over 150. I think you probably would have too if I'd given you that fact set. And when you get something wrong like that, the first step is you have to admit that you got it wrong. There's nothing wrong with getting things wrong. Nobody bats 1,000. Far more interesting to us to try and understand why we got it wrong. And we've done a few pieces in that regard. Because if you don't admit when you're wrong, how can you learn from being wrong? You know, we're, as I was getting ready to hop on with you, we've got a very provocative piece we're about to put out on the state of affairs in Great Britain and what it might mean for the future of North Sea oil production. Very speculative piece, probably going to look silly if it doesn't happen, but man, if it does, it's going to be a great early call. And that's the kind of stuff we like to do, you know. So if you can't reconcile when you don't get things right, then you're far, you're never going to improve in this business as well. So I do think, to answer the question specifically, if war doesn't break out again, even if the strait stays closed, I don't think we'll see that 150 number. And I think once whatever metastable state arises, materializes, you're going to see huge downward pressure on oil as new supply comes online. There's just a lot of oil in the world, Tom. Mm-hmm. And then if the strait were to reopen, if some extended ceasefire, multi-year ceasefire, sort of Korean style end to the war where neither side admits it won or lost, or, you know, neither side admits it lost and both sides can pretend like they won, and oil production resumes in the Middle East, well, I mean, look out below.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario to have happen out of something like this that, you know, drove oil past $100. But, you know, we also touched on this idea, or you touched on this idea of the market's ability to get these molecules to where they need to go and the efficiency of basically the market. Does this catalyze a country like Canada to be able to, you know, take some of the mental roadblocks out of the way to bring more of its energy to market as well?
Yeah, look, I think Mark Carney's odyssey to unstick Alberta's energy has been the subject of many articles in our archives, and a call that, much like the one we're about to make in with respect to Great Britain, one that I think we got quite early and quite right, to the surprise of many of our Canadian subscribers. I think the signing of the second MOU between Carney and Smith means that pipeline is going to be built and that Canadian energy will be unstuck. And Carney was the perfect person to do it. But it's not just Canada. It's Guyana, Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, Mexico. There's just in the Western Hemisphere 10 to 15 million barrels of oil to be had. Then you look around the world, China's shale. Russia has enormous capacity to produce way more oil. Russia could satisfy all of China's demand if China were willing to have its customer rich, its customer concentration reach such high levels. You know, this will all get undone, and Canada has an important role. Well, Canada is sitting on one of the largest hydrocarbon accumulations on Earth. It has hardly any people. Canadians should be amongst the richest people in the world. And Albertans' separatist movement is pushing in that direction.
Do you think that this pipeline is going to be used as a leverage point to try to keep Alberta from separating?
I mean, that was our whole call all the way back in December of 2024 when we wrote Alberta Clipper. And then in April of 25, when we wrote the follow-up piece called The Fix Is In. The sovereignty crisis is fake and is needed to run cover to undo the carbon lunacy that had overtaken Canadian liberal politics for the past two decades. And Mark Carney, in the same way that only Richard Nixon could go to China, you know, the staunch anti-communist, only a carbon evangelical like Carney could undo it. If, you know, Pierre the Apple Eater was the one who undid Canadian carbon policy, there'd be outrage, there'd be riots in the streets. But because Carney is viewed by the environmental left as one of their own, only he could do it, and which is why he was selected for the job. And that's, we think a replay of that is about to happen in Britain.
How does, you know, Canadian energy deal with the lack of refineries within Canada? Or do they only need to export the raw products in order to, you know, basically capitalize enough to continue to maybe develop that infrastructure?
Well, I think it takes pipelines to move diesel and gasoline and jet fuel around too. And so the easier thing to do is just build the crude pipeline for now. But once such infrastructure is built, you could also imagine implementing refining capacity as well. I mean, the Canadian market for refined products is small compared to its potential. And so it would be specifically building them for export only. Whereas China built up its, refining capacity because it has a huge domestic need. And so that was a way for it to insulate itself from events like what we see now. And so when you're looking at the national decision to build out refining, the resiliency dividend is not there for Canada because it already produces enough refined products for basically what it needs. And so there's no resiliency dividend for the country. And so it just exports the crude and off it goes. Right now, the real problem is it only has, aside from, a little less than 1 million barrels a day, it only has one customer for that crude, which is the U.S., which is why Western Canadian Select trades at such a discount. That's the risk that Russia runs by getting too close to China. Concentration risk works both ways.
Mm-hmm. And, thinking about, again, the timelines of things like this, obviously it's going to take, years to be able to build this pipeline. Is it possible that, Canada's debt situation becomes unsustainable to a point before we can actually capitalize on, exporting more oil?
Canada has no real debt situation to be worried about. The size of the resources available to mortgage is enormous. Just a matter of cutting the right deal at the right time. Canada per capita, like Australia, ought to be the wealthiest country in the world. Both Australia and Canada have tiny populations, huge resources, vast swaths of land, sophisticated populations, durable institutions. I know there's a lot of pessimism within Canada in particular about the trajectory of the country. Count us among the optimistic crowd when looking at Canada for all of its challenges and polarizations and immigration issues and the like. If you spun the globe and randomly selected a country to live in, Canada is still a pretty good outcome. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much in the way of resources in Canada that it just, I haven't looked at the fiscal imbalances in Canada that closely, but with 30, 40 million people, it can't be that insurmountable compared to the asset base. So when you look at a national balance sheet, the accounting rules really matter. Mm-hmm. Uranium, food, fertilizer, oil, gas, water. Enormous amount of water, fresh water, access to the Arctic, deep water ports, river systems, fishery, forest land, timberland. It's just incredible, the resource base, especially per capita. So it just can't be that Canada's anywhere near being broke.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just a matter of, again, taking those mental roadblocks or the roadblocks that exist between the politicians' ears in order to, as you and I have talked about before, in order to bring those resources to market, right?
That's what Carney's effectively trying to do with Alberta, right? Mm-hmm. And Daniel Smith, you notice it's not a company that's bringing this project forward to Ottawa. It's the province of Alberta, mm-hmm. right? It's government standing in front of what would be sort of point sources of protest and criticism in the form of individual companies. So I think there's a lot of good things happening in Canada today. And again, every time we say that, you could imagine that our Canadian subscribers skew a bit conservative. And so we get some pushback when we express this optimistic view of Canada. But you can't be that resource rich and fiscally poor. You just can't. You can't spend enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, to get a more accurate picture of what's happening in the world, something that you and I have talked about before. You are very deliberate about seeking propaganda from other countries. So how does this practice, you know, help paint a more accurate picture of something we touched on earlier? This is Trump's and basically the top American CEO's visit to China.
You know, as a slight diversion, we've recently contracted to write a book, and the point of the book looks like it'll be capturing how we think and how we analyze the world. And the first chapter to that book is tentatively titled, you know, Why Most Analyses Fail. That is because of a lack of a systematic information aggregating and grading mechanism. Mm-hmm. So we proactively seek as wide an array of information as possible, and then are continuously assessing the quality of that information versus the most important thing, which is how predictive it was. Mm-hmm. And far too few people have an aperture that is wide enough for inbound information that allows them to see a more holistic picture. Now, look, there's a lot of garbage in the world. Just because we consume a lot of information doesn't mean most of it isn't garbage, which makes the second part of that strategy really important, which is the ability to grade it. So take this war in Iran. We wrote a piece where we described how we use the Twitter algorithm to find for us high signal contributors on Twitter. Do we agree with everything they say? No. Did we, in searching for these accounts, find an enormous amount of misinformation, disinformation, deep fakes, propaganda, and other nonsense? Of course. Mm-hmm. But if you get good at grading such information and you have a wide aperture to bring in as many sources of data as you can into your sort of your field of analysis, then you put yourself at a huge advantage. And so what's going on with China today? Well, if you're not reading Chinese social media, the major Chinese papers, which are, of course, outlets of the Chinese Communist Party, and the official readouts, even if you know their propaganda, if you're not reading them, you're missing part of the picture. Mm-hmm. What the Communist Party is telling its citizens is an input into what actually happened. What is missing from the readouts is also an input into what actually happened. When you read the Russian and Chinese readouts side by side, are there differences? What do those differences mean? Historically, how accurate have these readouts been? The Chinese have typically been quite guarded in what they say. So when they say something significant, you take a step back and say, oh, okay, this is interesting. They actually said it overtly. What was the exact language they used to frame the Taiwan issue versus the language they've used in the past? Mm-hmm. Has it changed? Those types of analyses give you an edge, I think, than just reading what The Economist tells you about the meeting or what the Financial Times tells you about the meeting. We read those too. I'll give you a great example. From the China meeting with Trump, we read the Financial Times. Financial Times is a great newspaper, but every once in a while, a big high-profile story is printed in the Financial Times and we recoil at it and say, that is BS. That story isn't true. Mm-hmm. And we just had an example of that. Front page, top of the fold yesterday. Xi Jinping told Trump that Putin will come to regret the invasion of Ukraine. That was the top story. You know, classic sources familiar with. There's precisely zero chance that conversation happened as described. It is utterly inconsistent with how Xi Jinping has carried himself since ascending to the top position. It's absolutely not anything he would say to Trump. And it just wouldn't happen the way it was described. And yet, 9 out of 10 things we read in the Financial Times are interesting and well-sourced and we believe to be true. You have to have that system for grading it. And also the experience to say every once in a while, the Financial Times publishes what is an obvious piece of puff propaganda. It's a British outlet. You have to understand that when you're reading Reuters, you're reading British news. It might be more sophisticated than the British tabloids, but it's still a British outlet. And so when an event like what's happening in China, in fact, that we view the Trump and Putin trips to China as a continuation of the same event, when you see these sequential meetings in Beijing at this time in the middle of a war, well, two wars, you really have to deploy all of your tactics and techniques to get as good an understanding of what's going on as possible. And then you always have to be refining them because sometimes, well, you often get things wrong.
So has China confirmed any of what Trump's claims were post-meeting?
Not really. And look, Trump has a way of saying a lot of things. One of the things that any objective analyst would have to admit is that you can't take what Trump says when he's talking to the media at face value. You can't take what he posts on Truth Social at face value.
I think there was that saying, take him seriously, but not literally.
Even the seriously part sometimes. honestly, I mean, if you just went back to his Truth Social feed and for the month of March did an objective analysis of the number of statements of fact that he made and then questioned whether those were true, I think you would be surprised, perhaps, at what a low hit rate he's had. And so then, knowing that, because we've done that, how do you grade inbound Truth Social posts, for example? So when you see the post yesterday about Qatar and UAE and Saudi Arabia, you know, asking Trump not to attack Iran, whenever that post was out, our first thought was, did they actually say that? We would doubt it. We suspect that perhaps Trump was told that's what would happen to those countries, and then he just posted that. He does this all the time. It's not even a criticism of Trump. It's just an observation. You can't take what he posts or what he says to the press at face value. You just can't. Mm-hmm. You never really could, but you certainly can't now.
So what do you think are the actual outcomes of that particular meeting? Are they, you know, trying to do more business together? Is that the reason that the CEOs were over there as well?
I don't know what came out of the meeting. One of the head scratchers is it seems like nothing came out of that meeting. Mm-hmm. Yes, there were some announcements about some planes and some soybeans, but there was no grand bargain. If you contrast that with what happened today, for example, Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin held an extensive press conference together. Mm-hmm. Trump and Xi Jinping did not do that when Trump was there. A formal set of documents were signed and explained and included in the readouts. That did not happen mm-hmm. with Trump's visit. So who knows what happened when Trump with this? It's actually quite mysterious how such a summit of extreme importance like that could result in so little officially. Now, it's always possible that some grand bargain was struck behind the scenes, and we'll come to learn of that in the future, and we don't dismiss that as a possibility for sure. But the official readouts were quite lacking. And certainly, if anything, it has hardened Iran's position in the Middle East, for example. Like, one of the things that I think the market might have been hoping for was that some kind of grand bargain would be struck where a way out of Iran would be found and some face-saving, you know, mechanism could be invented that allows both sides to step back from the brink. That didn't happen, at least not officially, not publicly. Mm-hmm. Which is why I think you saw the price of oil spike $5-6 when Trump got on the plane to leave, and there was no such announcements. Because I think the market was kind of hoping for that, and it didn't get it. So if you have a different view, I'm happy to hear it, but that's our assessment so far.
Well, and that's exactly why I'm trying to ask, you know, somebody that reads very widely, because that is basically the same assessment that I came to as well. Is like, there's nothing concrete. There's nothing, let's say, confirmed from both sides that I saw come out of any part of that.
Yeah, look, I mean, if Iran thinks it has leverage over the U.S., and let's just, for the purposes of brainstorming, assume that they actually do. Mm-hmm. If Iran has leverage over the U.S., China and Russia know it. Maybe they're not interested in helping the U.S. out of this situation. Maybe they believe that time is on their side, that they can just keep going with the current state, that the U.S. will run out of missiles, attack missiles, defense missiles, that the U.S. will run out of money to keep this blockade going. You know, it's expensive to keep this blockade going. Mm-hmm. That they can keep Iran supplied through the Caspian Sea and overland rail links, that they could support the current government, and that there is no military solution to this war, and that the longer this goes on, the stronger the sort of collective hand of Russia, Iran, and China will be. And maybe Trump was simply turned away. Solve your own problem with a polite pat on the back. I don't know. I mean, that's certainly a negative spin on what happened, but it's hard to find evidence to contradict that. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting as well. I saw China had put out a statement about Taiwan, kind of highlighting the importance of the U.S. needing to respect China's strategy, China's reunification strategy at this point. Do you think that this is a very strategic time for China to maybe, you know, reunite Taiwan because they see the ability of the U.S. to not fight two wars simultaneously?
Well, I mean, if anything came out of this meeting, it was Trump's comments about Taiwan afterwards that were most interesting, weren't they? I mean, and Trump correctly characterized the, I would say, military impossibility of resisting China if it were to make a move on Taiwan. I think he said, you know, they're 60 miles apart and we're, you know, however many miles away. How is the U.S. supposed to interject? He didn't, of course, mention that the war in Iran weakened that possibility even further, but that was the implication. Mm-hmm. And I think that is actually the correct assessment. There is quite literally nothing the U.S. can do to protect Taiwan if China made a move today. And that is just an agnostic, realistic assessment of what the war in Iran has taught the rest of the world. Whether listening to this, you believe it, you, the listener, not you, Tom, is not relevant. What's relevant is whether the Chinese believe it, and you could rest assured that Chinese satellite technology has been all over this war. We've seen it. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why we've been able to get an edge on what actually happened in the war is because, unlike the U.S., which prohibited satellite companies from, Western satellite companies from producing evidence of what happened, seemingly authentic satellite pictures have been all over Chinese social media and have found their way into certain corners of Twitter, and we've been able to see them. Subsequent reporting in major legacy media outlets in the West have all but confirmed most of what we saw as being authentic. And it certainly is consistent with the behavior on the ground. So whatever we think happened, the Chinese have way better information than certainly Team Doomberg does, and a far more sophisticated way to grade that information than Team Doomberg does. And they're in a position to think strategically about it. And the one thing that has to be said about the nature of China's governance system is it does solve for strategic patience above almost all else. Mm-hmm. It is not worried about an election cycle in the way that Trump might be worried about the midterms. Even Putin is more answerable to the Russian people than the Chinese Communist Party is. By the way, that's not to say that the Chinese Communist Party is not responsive to the Chinese people and almost to the point of paranoia. Mm-hmm. But they don't have to worry about electoral cycles in the way that, for example, Trump does.
Yeah, well, I mean, that the quote-unquote democratic way or democratic system of these four-year cycles, I think, has been highlighted as a vulnerability to these systems rather than the ability to be strategic over a long period of time, like China or Russia.
Yeah, I mean, sure. There's lots of positive attributes to living in a Western-based democratic system, and I'm certainly glad that I do. Mm-hmm. But there are certain disadvantages to it. One of them is the foreign policy whiplash that makes doing a deal with the U.S. almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Just take the Iran situation. Again, whatever you think of President Obama, there was a negotiated deal with Iran. That deal was approved by the United Nations Security Council, of which the U.S. has veto power. And European countries were signed up for verification. And there's no evidence that Iran had violated the deal whatsoever when Trump ripped it up after he got into office and replaced Obama. You might think Trump ripping up that deal was the right move. You might think that Obama was insane to strike the deal that he did with the Iranians. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the rest of the world looks at the U.S. and says, huh, a sitting U.S. president committed the U.S. to a certain course. That course got the blessing of the United Nations Security Council. And one election later, at the whims of a new president, ripped it up. And now there happens to be a war over that exact issue, which Obama claimed to have solved. Mm-hmm. Still claims to have solved, by the way, if you've listened to his most recent interview. That means that whatever deal you strike with Trump now, who knows what Gavin Newsom's going to do if he becomes president, you know? Or Elizabeth mm-hmm. Warren, Bernie Sanders, pick your favorite. And so if there's no durability to the U.S. word, then you really can't negotiate with the U.S. Why would Iran negotiate with Trump now? Not even that they would wait for a better deal. It's just that the U.S. is not a country that you can cut a deal with. And then the Iran situation makes it even more challenging, because is the U.S. even a country you can negotiate with? This is twice now. During active negotiations, the U.S. attempted or participated in the attempt of a decapitation strike against the people they were negotiating with. Who would want to negotiate with the U.S. at this point?
I was going to say, going to negotiate with the U.S. can be hazardous to your health.
Right. So why would you? I mean, not only might it end up in your death, the deal would not be kept.
Yeah.
And so this is not to say that Obama struck a good deal with Iran, or that in isolation, Trump ripping it up was a bad decision. But the second and third order consequence of that, again, you have the blessing of the United Nations Security Council. The U.S., China, Russia, France, and Great Britain have veto power over those resolutions. Nobody chose to exercise that veto. By all accounts, Iran stayed true to what it had committed to in that heavily negotiated deal. And it was ripped up, and now there's a war. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you want to negotiate with the U.S. given that fact set?
Dumerg, something that I've been trying to wrap my mind around here, especially as energy is concerned, is this massive build-out of AI data centers and how they affect the, you know, access to power and, you know, the growing need for more power. Is this something that is a big race on all, let's say, all sides of the globe, or let's say even more specifically, the US versus China? And again, bringing the strategy into this calculation of having more access to energy, is this something that China is more capable of building out at this point?
Yeah. Look, the war in the Middle East has very little to do with AI in our view, because and we just did a doom zoom on this for our pro tier last month. The U.S. AI efforts are largely powered by natural gas, mm-hmm. and China's AI efforts are largely powered by coal. And so the flow of oil and refined products out of the Middle East is going to have little in the way of impact on both of those efforts. We've seen the theory that, Venezuela and now the Middle East are part of some broader disrupt China's AI ambitions plan of the US. We don't think that's true, at least materially, and hardly even true superficially. There are other reasons why these wars have been undertaken. The AI race in particular is not one of them. The human endeavor is infinite compute is one of our operating mental models, and nothing about this war in the Middle East changes that. The demand for natural gas in the US is going to continue to grow higher. We are surprised it has taken this long for the US government to mandate that big AI data centers be moved off grid. The competition for residential and traditional industrial electricity, we think, has been allowed to go on for too long, that the two are irreconcilable. You can't achieve your AI goals and have a stable grid for the rest of the economy to use. And so, in our view, the natural outcome of that has to be a bifurcation of electricity generation, dedicated for data centers and dedicated for the grid. But that's all, subject for future pontifications, I suppose.
Do you have any thoughts as to that being the less, let's say, hazardous outcome rather than almost the opening of Pandora's box if AGI is actually built?
Yeah, I would have to say that the probability of AGI materializing anytime soon is beyond our scope of expertise to comment on. I certainly read the debate around that subject with great interest. One of my good friends in this space, who happens to be a founder of an AI startup, believes that the AGI boogeyman has been exaggerated by big AI in the hopes of pulling up the regulatory ladders to keep their moat. But I'm not expert enough to give a good assessment of the pros and cons of that argument.
Well, Doomberg, I appreciate you taking the time to walk through many of these different aspects of what is happening in the world. It's always crazy to think about how different the world looks from the last time we spoke, and I always appreciate getting to discuss that with you. Is
Yeah,
there anything
same.
you'd like to leave our listeners with to before we wrap up here?
Yeah, no, Tom, it's always great to talk with you. Just a housekeeping note on Doomberg. You can find everything at doomberg.com. And after May 31st, the cost of a Doomberg subscription is going to be going up, which means that if you subscribe between now and June 1st, you will get the heritage rate and will be able to renew at that rate. All existing subscribers to Doomberg won't see a price change, but if you're sitting on the fence and you like what you heard today and you think about maybe giving a Doomberg subscription a chance, you have a closing window to lock in the old rate for our annual subscriptions, which will be going up by $100 a year after May 31st. So appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Tom. Congrats again on your success and looking forward to watching you grow on the Substack medium as well.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate the support as well, Doomberg. Thank you.